Okay, so thanks for inviting me for the seminar and for tolerating a remote seminar since I'm teaching frequently this term. So I'm going to talk about mainly this paper from last year with Brian Swingle and Moshe Rosali, and then various students at UBC, Sean Cooper, Chris Waddell, and David Wakeham. And I'll tell you a little bit about some work in progress as well. And so the kind of setup for the whole thing is that in quantum gravity, two of the main reasons we're interested in studying that are to understand better the physics of black holes, and also to understand the physics of the very early universe, the Big Bang and cosmology, perhaps to understand what dark energy is. And so in this talk, we're going to be thinking about both of these questions, and we'll be studying those in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is going to be our theoretical model for quantum gravity. And so I don't know who I'm talking to, but the ADS-CFT correspondence that I'm going to make use of in this talk will be kind of the global version. So I'll be thinking about a conformal field theory defined on a sphere. And then I'll be thinking about states of that. And those will correspond to various space-times that are asymptotically globally ADS. So I want to review a little bit, since we'll be thinking about black holes in this context, I want to review a little bit about how do we describe CFT states that describe black holes. And so the basic idea is you just put a lot of energy into the CFT, and then the state that you get is likely to be encoding a black hole. So I think in 98, Witten originally pointed out that, or suggested that, if you look at the thermal state of a CFT, then that should correspond to a black hole in anti-de Sitter space. But we could be a little bit more precise and ask, well, how much, if we have that thermal state, does that correspond to sort of the complete space-time of the black hole? Is it just describing the outside of the black hole outside the horizon? If it's more than that, what is exactly behind the horizon? And so it's interesting to think a little bit more precisely about what it means for the thermal state to be dual to a black hole. Okay. And so if we think about a thermal state of a CFT, well, that's not a pure state, it's a mixed state, as described by a thermal density matrix. And there are really two ways to think about that. So we can think about the density matrix as describing the CFT as a subsystem of some larger system. Okay, so the CFT, and then coupled to some heat bath, and we have a pure state of the whole system, and the subsystem of the CFT is described by this density matrix. Okay, so that would be one viewpoint on what this thermal state could mean. Another viewpoint would be to say that this thermal state, we're just thinking of the density matrix as describing some ensemble of pure states. And those would be pure states of the single CFT. And on the gravity side, we would call those some black hole microstates. Okay. So it's actually interesting then for these two viewpoints to ask the question of what would this pure state on this side be dual to, or what would these microstates be dual to? And so one good piece of progress along these lines came from Maldacena in 2001, where he argued that some particular purification of this thermal density matrix corresponds to a very particular extension of the black hole spacetime. And so the purification he was talking about is this symmetrical thermofield double state, where we have two copies of the CFT, and we entangle those in such a way that each CFT has a density matrix that's thermal. And so Maldacena argued that this particular purification of the thermal density matrix should be dual to the maximally extended black hole space-time where we have two asymptotically ADS regions. Each of those includes a black hole, and then the black holes are connected behind their horizons in the usual way. Okay, so that's one particular purification, and we have a very plausible proposal for what that would be dual to in ADS CFT. But the interesting thing is that there could be many other purifications of the same thermal density matrix. So even in the same system of two CFTs, there would be an infinite number of other purifications, and all of those would look like this here at the bottom, where we start with that thermofield double state, and then we act with some unitary operator on say the other copy of the CFT. Okay, so this state down here, if you evaluate the density matrix for CFT1, it's still the thermal density matrix. But if you evaluate the density matrix for CFT2, it's something different. And one can understand on the gravity side what that would mean. So one way to think about such a unitary operator or some specific class of unitary operators would be some small local perturbation that we make on this CFT. Okay, and so in ADS CFT, so if we act with some nearly local operator at some particular time, so that should create some excitation in the asymptotic region near that second boundary, and that might propagate forward, or maybe it came from the past. So it will modify the full space-time potentially everywhere except in the original Schwarzschild exterior. So we have a kind of family of possible purifications, and it seems like those are maybe all dual to different space-times that share this same Schwarzschild exterior geometry. So depending on how we purify the thermal state, we always get the Schwarzschild exterior, but we might get all kinds of different things behind the horizon. Okay, so that suggests that this thermal state itself, if we just know that the one CFT is in the thermal density matrix, probably the only information that gives us about the dual space-time is information about the region outside the horizon. Okay, so if that's true, then it's somewhat confusing when we take this other perspective. If we think about that same thermal density matrix as now describing an ensemble of pure states, okay. So we might think that for any given black hole microstate in that ensemble, okay, since that's a pure state, it's sort of complete information about the state of a CFT, it should maybe also have complete information about the dual geometry. And so we might think that there should be an answer to what is behind the horizon of the black hole here. But somehow, by our previous argument, if we consider the ensemble of all of those things, then there isn't a definite answer to that question. So it's a little bit of a mystery for these pure states, what would be behind the horizon. And there has been now significant controversy about the answer to this question. I'll refer you to the firewall debate from 2013 and later, but I won't get into that in too much detail. Okay, so for this talk, what I want to do is not try to answer this question in general, but actually just think about a particular class of black hole microstates of these high energy states of the CFT, where I think we can get a direct understanding of what is the full space-time geometry that those states are describing. Okay, and so this work is motivated by work of Kurkulu and Maldacena, who made a similar construction to the one that I'll describe in the SYK model. So we've kind of taken their ideas and explored them in the context of more full-fledged holographic theories. Okay, So the states that I want to consider are states of the CFT where we are going to use Euclidean path integrals to define those. So let me remind you that if I want to describe the vacuum state of a CFT or actually any other quantum system, one way I can do that is to start with any state, some kind of arbitrary state, which has some overlap with the vacuum state. And then I act with this Euclidean time evolution. So I act with e to the minus beta h, and I take beta to be very large. And the limit where beta goes to infinity, what happens is that all of the non-vacuum contributions in this superposition of energy eigenstates are going to be suppressed and will be left with just the vacuum state. Okay. So that expression there, one can in the usual way convert that into a path integral expression. And so what that tells me is that, so one way to describe that path integral expression is to say that if we want to describe the vacuum wave functional, okay, so the wave functional evaluated on some particular field configuration, what we do is this path integral, so this is the sphere on which our CFT lives, and this is some Euclidean time direction that we've introduced that goes to tau equals minus infinity, and the vacuum wave functional is equal to the integral over all possible field configurations on that semi-infinite cylinder with the boundary condition that the field at tau equals zero is equal to our field configuration that we're trying to evaluate the wave functional on. Okay, so that's a state of the CFT, which has a nice gravity dual. It's dual to pure ADS. But it turns out that modifying this path integral in various ways is actually a good way to generate other kind of states of the CFT, which have nice gravity dual descriptions. So actually, before I get there, let me just mention some examples. We could actually add sources here. So modify this Euclidean action and add sources for various light operators, which would be dual to the light fields in the bulk. Okay. And that would, if we make sure to turn the sources off by tau equals zero so that we're not actually modifying the theory, those states will give rise to various kinds of excited states of our CFT. And then there's actually a direct recipe to understand what would the gravity dual to those states be. Okay. So in this talk, we're not going to add explicit sources. I'll do a different modification of the path integral. So what I'm going to do is take this vacuum path integral, and then instead of integrating over field configurations, where on this semi-infinite cylinder, I'm going to cap off the cylinder at some finite past Euclidean time, so tau zero in the past. And what I'll do to in order to make that well defined is choose some boundary condition for my Euclidean CFT that I'm doing this path integral over. Okay, So the blue circle here is the place where I'm imposing this boundary condition. Okay. And so another way to describe this is that now we're doing a finite amount of Euclidean time evolution, starting with what is referred to as a boundary state. And that's basically just a shorthand for this path integral. Okay, so our state is now defined by the parameter tau zero, as well as which boundary condition we choose. Okay, so I want to tell you a little bit more about boundary conditions for CFTs and how to interpret those in the context of holography. Okay, so what is happening here at this blue circle? Okay, so the idea is that if we have any CFT, then there would be various consistent choices of boundary conditions for that theory. And so, for example, if we think about a free scalar field defined on this half space, we could choose to impose a Neumann boundary condition there or a Dirichlet boundary condition. For more complicated CFTs, such as the holographic ones, there can be many, many possible choices of boundary condition that would be consistent. We'll be focusing on a special kind of boundary condition. So it's possible if you start with a CFT that has the usual conformal invariance, it's possible to choose boundary conditions that preserve the conformal invariance in one lower dimension. Okay, so of course we're breaking some of the symmetry by introducing a boundary, but we can actually preserve scale invariance together with the rest of the conformal invariance for that lower dimensional for that lower dimensional theory. And so those are the kinds of boundary conditions that I'm going to be talking about mainly in this talk. Okay, and again, there's many possible choices of such conformally invariant boundary conditions. More general boundary conditions we could actually think of as some RG flows. So you could start with one of these conformally invariant boundary conditions and perturb the theory by some relevant boundary operator, and that could define an RG flow from one conformally invariant boundary condition to another conformally invariant boundary condition. We could also consider boundary conditions that don't preserve translation invariance. So there are lots of choices, but for this talk, we're going to stick with the kind of simplest, most symmetric boundary conditions. Okay, so let me just mention in a familiar context some of the boundary conditions that we would have for our favorite holographic theory. So if I start with n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, then I might decide I want to preserve not only the this conformal invariance, but also some of the supersymmetry. And actually, the possible half-supersymmetric boundary conditions for n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory have been classified by Gero and Witten. And a way to understand those is that if you think of the n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory as coming from the low-energy limit of D3 brains in string theory, well, you can define that theory with these various half-supersymmetric boundary conditions by starting with D3 brains in string theory, but having them end on D5 brains or NS5 brains in some specific orientations. And there's many possible ways to set up a situation like that. And so for any one of those, we can now take the low energy limit. And what we end up with is our N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, but then it ends at some particular spatial coordinate, and then there would be a boundary condition which is labeled by the data that describes how many D5s and NS5s we have and how the D3 brains end on those. Okay. All right, so that's the CFT story, but now we want to understand what is the holographic story? How do we understand the dual of one of these CFTs with boundary conditions? And there are kind of two approaches that have been used in the previous literature on this subject. So one of them I will call the bottom-up approach. This was introduced, I think, originally by Karch and Randall, but emphasized by Takayanagi. So the idea there is that we have a CFT with some boundary. The CFT would be dual to some bulk space-time that's asymptotically locally ADS. But something has to happen. Something has to happen with this boundary as we move into the bulk. And the simplest idea would be that the boundary also appears. It sort of extends into the bulk space-time as something that we'll call an end of the world brain. Okay. So the bottom-up approach. So just like in the bottom-up approach to ordinary ADS CFT, where we just sort of specify some bulk set of fields and some bulk Lagrangian, we're just going to do that for this boundary end of the world brain as well. So we'll say that our boundary CFT is dual to a bulk theory. Maybe it's Einstein gravity. In this case, it'll just be gravity, but we could have scalar fields and other fields as well. But now we'll say that when you have a boundary in the CFT, then there's also this this end of the world brain, and we're going to model that by some boundary action, which would include boundary cosmological constant or a tension for this boundary brain, and possibly couplings to bulk fields as well. So that's the bottom up approach. If you want to be more microscopic, then actually for many of these half BPS examples, so if we have N=4 super Yang-Mills theory with half supersymmetric boundary conditions, then there are actually solutions known for the duals of those states, of those theories in the vacuum state. So if I have N=4 on a half space with a particular half supersymmetric boundary condition in the vacuum state, that has a certain symmetry that it preserves. And actually you can look for all the possible solutions of type 2B supergravity with that symmetry, and then kind of match parameters to identify which solution corresponds to which theory. So let me just say, in those full 10-dimensional solutions, we don't have an explicit end of the world brain. So what happens there is that we have an internal space. So just, you know, we would have ADS5 times S5 asymptotically here. But then something happens with the internal space. And the way that I like to think about it is, so similar to a bubble of nothing geometry, where you have an extra circular dimension, and then at the edge of the bubble of nothing, that circular dimension can just pinch off smoothly. So from the lower dimensional perspective, you have an end of the world, your space-time ends at some coordinate, but from the higher dimensional perspective, the whole space-time is smooth, and it's just that the extra dimension has, it's kind of degenerated in a smooth way. Okay, so in these microscopic solutions, this end of the world brain is not really necessarily a physical brain. It can be something more smooth, and there's some detailed higher dimensional description. Okay, so as I said, we're mostly going to be using this bottom-up approach. And in our model, we'll be mainly considering just a bulk theory with an Einstein action. And then for the end of the world brain, the parameter that we'll be incorporating into the model is just a tension parameter for that brain. So I wanted to mention some work of Taki and Ayi that helped us understand how to think about that tension parameter and the relation between that and the dual field theory. Okay, so when you have a boundary CFT, here I'm drawing a two-dimensional picture, but more or less the same idea applies to higher dimensions. So if I have a boundary CFT, we have the central charge parameter that is related to the number of bulk degrees of freedom, but there's another parameter which is called boundary entropy that in some sense gives you a measure of the number of boundary degrees of freedom. So one place where that shows up is if I calculate the entanglement entropy in the vacuum state for an interval that includes the boundary. And then there's a term here which involves the bulk central charge. And then correcting that is this extra term log G, which we call, it's like a boundary central charge, or this is what's called the boundary entropy. So we can think of larger values of this as maybe telling us that the boundary conditions that we're using have in some sense more degrees of freedom, or the theory with those boundary conditions has more degrees of freedom than the theory with some smaller boundary entropy. Okay. So Taki and Ayi kind of pointed out a relationship between that parameter and the tension parameter of the end of the world brain in a bottom-up model. Okay. So if we have this picture, This is the, say, a boundary CFT, let's say it's in the vacuum state, and we want to figure out the gravity dual to that, then we have an asymptotically ADS space-time where this end of the world brain goes off at some direction from the boundary of the CFT. So what I've drawn here would be actually just, say, Poincaré coordinates. This is the z coordinate going into the bulk, And then the tension of this brain is directly related to this angle. So zero tension, the brain goes straight up. Positive tension, it goes this way. Negative tension, it would go the other way. If I do a holographic calculation of entanglement entropy for the same interval, including the boundary, so then using the RT formula, we have to find the area of some extremal surface. And now this extremal surface can end on our end of the world brain. So we have this particular configuration. We evaluate the area of that. It has one piece, which you can think of as being as coming from this part of the end of the world brain up to the vertical line. That reproduces this term in the boundary in the entropy. And then there's this other piece, which depends on the angle, which in turn depends on the tension. Okay, so the bottom line of all this is that if you make an equivalence between the arctanch of this tension parameter and the boundary entropy, then the CFT formula for entanglement entropy matches with the gravity formula. So the takeaway there is that we're going to be using a tension parameter in our bottom-up ADS-CFT model. We should think of that as being related to our choice of boundary condition and specifically kind of the number of degrees of freedom that boundary condition would be associated with. An interesting question is, given a particular CFT, what are the possible values of this boundary entropy? Or for the corresponding holographic model, what are the possible values of this tension? And with Chris Swaddell, we're currently exploring the answer to this question in some of the microscopic theories, for example, n equals 4 with various half-supersymmetric boundary conditions. Okay, so there you could just compute the entropy directly in the known gravity dual solutions and kind of read off what this boundary entropy is. Okay, maybe I should, are there any questions at this point? Is there any audience at this point? Okay, I'll keep going. So let's recall how we were going to use, where is this boundary condition coming in for us? Okay. So I'm still going to be considering just an ordinary CFT on a sphere. So the theory that I'm dealing with does not have a boundary. The relevance of these boundary conditions for us is going to be in a description of some particular excited states of that CFT. Okay. And so what we have here is this path integral where in the Euclidean past, we place a boundary condition. So we're using a Euclidean boundary CFT to define a state of an ordinary Lorentzian CFT on a sphere. Okay, and so we wanna know, so this is our state, and we wanna know what is the dual geometry to that state. And so there's basically a recipe, since we have a holographic prescription for dealing with the boundary condition, there's now going to be a recipe that we can use to deduce the dual geometry. And so the recipe kind of uses the equivalence between CFT partition functions and gravity partition functions. And so, or CFT path integrals and gravity path integrals. So let's think about starting with this state and imagine we want to compute something, for example, this correlation function of operators at the initial time. Okay, so then we would write down a path integral that looks like this. This bottom part corresponds to the ket, and the top part corresponds to the bra, and then we could insert various operators along the blue region. Okay. And so we would then do this path integral in the CFT. Okay. But that should be equivalent to some gravity path integral, and that gravity path integral should be dominated by some particular saddle point. And so that would be a solution to the gravitational equations of motion, where we have an asymptotically ADS geometry whose boundary geometry is exactly this cylinder. Okay. So that Euclidean solution, then I'll mention in a couple of slides how that will, from that we can extract the information that tells us what Lorentzian solution is dual to our state. Okay. So first let's think of the Euclidean solution. So what do these asymptotically ADS geometries look like where the boundary geometry is like a finite cylinder? So now we have to use our bottom-up prescription for dealing with this boundary CFT holographically. And so the idea there is that the two boundaries in the CFT should extend into the bulk somehow. And turns out that there are kind of two obvious topologies that we can have that might give the saddle point for our gravity calculation. And which one of these dominates depends on our choice of B and the value of this tau zero parameter. Okay. So what we'll be interested in, it'll turn out that this particular Euclidean solution is the one that corresponds to having a black hole in the Lorentzian case. And this one corresponds to not having a black hole. So this is a little bit like the Hawking-Page transition where for certain parameter values, okay, so for small values of beta, you would have one solution that would be dual to some black hole. For large values of beta, you would have another solution that's dual to just pure ADS with some gas of graviton. So for us, we're interested in investigating black hole space-time. So we're going to be interested in this particular Euclidean solution. And that one turns out to be the dominant one for small values of this parameter tau zero.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah.
We had a question on this.
Okay. So okay.
I have a question. If you want to understand the calculation from the gravity point of view, you have to specify the boundary condition on this red surface for the gravity field. So what do you take?
Yeah, that's a good question. So
infinite sense of possible.
Yeah, that's right. So we have to choose so we're kind of using Takayanagi's prescription. So first, like we're specifying some particular boundary action with a Gibbons Hawking term and then a tension term. And then for the boundary condition, we want one way to think about it is we don't want anything to be able to flow through the boundary. So we're essentially choosing something like a Neumann boundary condition for the gravity solution. And then what we end up giving is some equation that,
on the boundary, what are you can either fix the metric or the momentum, and then which metric do you choose or which conjugate variable do you choose? What value? It's a field, right? You have to choose a field of value on the boundary.
Yeah, that's a good question. So we're not fixing the metric, okay? So we're kind of choosing we're choosing the analog of a Neumann condition. Yeah. What it translates to is basically a formula. I think in the end, there's a formula that just sets the extrinsic curvature to be related to this tension parameter. So this is in the end this is the thing that we have the bulk equation, and then we supplement that with some equation that sets, actually I think we just need the trace of the extrinsic curvature equal to some constant times the tension parameter. Okay, so that's the specific equation that this kind of Neumann boundary condition translates into.
But the trace is something you need to fix, but you also need to fix the extrinsic curvature tensor on the boundary if you want to specify the gravity path theorem, not only its trace.
For us, because we're working in a very symmetric situation, it's enough to fix the trace, but I think more generally then we would have some equation with indices that says the k mu nu equals some constant times t times g mu nu. So there's some equation like that. Okay.
Is that choice unique or determined by the
Yeah, this is a good question. I think there have been some discussions in the literature after Takayanagi's paper, discussing various possible choices. For us, because we're working in a situation which ends up being spherically symmetric, it seems like all of the choices reduce to the same thing for us. But I don't have a good answer to whether in generality whether it's understood what the natural choice should be. Now tell you, so this is a Euclidean solution that we could use to compute various things about our state. But what we were interested in is the Lorentzian black hole geometry. And so how we're going to understand that is basically thinking about this Euclidean path integral or this Euclidean solution as providing some initial data for our Lorentzian geometry. Okay, kind of like basically like in the Hartle-Hawking construction, what we can think of is the lower half of this picture, which is some Euclidean gravity solution that's asymptotically ADS, gives us now this gray slice in the middle, which is, so this is just a tau equals zero surface. We're going to think of that as our initial data for a Lorentzian geometry. And basically by our setup, these geometries are time symmetric, so symmetric under reversal of the Euclidean time. And so there's a natural time equals zero surface in the bulk geometry along which we can slice. And then we're just going to take the metric from that surface as the initial data for some Lorentzian evolution. Okay. So that's what I've shown in this picture. Okay, so if we want to think about what is the geometry of that initial data for the Lorentzian evolution, well, we have this red region, which is at the boundary. So that's an asymptotically ADS region. And then we go in from there to this dotted black circle, which is our end of the world brain. If we actually look at the metric on this surface, then what we have is something like this. Okay. So the spatial metric at time zero, it looks like a black hole exterior. Then you get to a region of minimum radius, and then it actually starts expanding again before you get to the end of the world brain. So the case I've drawn here, that is the case where you have a tension parameter greater than zero. I'll mention that if the tension parameter is less than zero, then the end of the world brain is actually outside this minimum radius region. Okay. But we're actually going to be focusing on this case with tension greater than zero. Okay, so what we've learned is that for these particular states that we're constructing, if we use a positive value of the tension parameter, then the geometry of the initial data slice is that of a black hole, the spatial geometry of a black hole, and that extends not just up to the horizon, but past the horizon, and eventually ends on some end of the world brain, like that. And so, as I mentioned, exactly where this inner edge is, where this inner end of the world brain is, it depends on the specific value of the tension parameter, and that ultimately is determined by the specific choice we make for the boundary conditions defining our state. So we have in mind that something with a larger boundary entropy will have a larger tension parameter, and that will lead to more space behind the horizon of the black hole. Okay, so that was the spatial picture at t equals zero. Now we can look at the space-time picture. Okay, and because the entire setup is spherically symmetric, so these geometries are completely spherically symmetric, but possibly time dependent. And since we are just looking at purely gravitational solutions, the full Lorentzian geometry has to be a part of the maximally extended Schwarzschild geometry. Okay, so the symmetry implies that the local geometry is that of the Schwarzschild. And so it turns out that the way to understand this initial data in the context of a full Lorentzian solution is by this picture. Okay. So this is like the Penrose diagram for a maximally extended black hole. What you have here is the initial data slice. You see that extends to the horizon and past it and ends on this end of the world brain. And now as a function of time, what you see is that the end of the world brain, it comes out of the past singularity, enters this second asymptotic region, and then goes back and ends at the future singularity. Yeah. So you have a full Schwarzschild exterior here, and then some interesting time-dependent physics behind the horizon. I'll mention in the tension less than zero case, the dynamics of this end of the world brain is happening outside the horizon for some time here. Okay, but again, we'll be focused on this case. Okay, so it's an interesting question. If these CFT states indeed correspond to some particular space-time geometries with some interesting time-dependent physics behind the horizon, what question could we ask about the CFT that would tell us about that behind the horizon geometry? Okay. So it turns out that one question we can ask about to diagnose that behind the horizon physics is to look at entanglement entropy for various subsystems of the CFT. Okay, so I'm just drawing the 2D case where my sphere is a circle. So we've set up some particular excited state of the CFT on a circle. And then what I could do is I could look at the entanglement entropy for some subsystem A, and I could actually look at that as a function of time. But first I'm going to think about that entanglement entropy at time equals zero, so in our original state. So if I use the Ryu-Takinagi prescription for computing that entanglement entropy, then for a small interval A, what I have is an RT surface that stays outside the black hole horizon. If I make the region a little bit bigger, then my RT surface probes a little bit further into the space-time. And then what happens, the interesting thing is that if I make my region large enough, so if I ask about the entanglement entropy of a large enough subsystem of the CFT, then what can happen is that even though there's still an RT surface, an extremal surface that stays outside the black hole horizon, there can be another RT surface which actually enters the black hole and ends on the end of the world brain. So in the two-dimensional case, this second choice of RT surface is actually a disconnected surface. So the union of these two blue curves here. In a higher dimensional case, this would be connected, there'd be sort of an extra, like this is an interval times S0 in the higher dimensional surface. The topology is some interval times S1 or S2 or S3, so it's all connected. Okay, so the interesting thing is that if we look at a large enough subsystem at time equals zero, then we can get an answer for the entanglement entropy, which actually depends on the detailed geometry behind the horizon. And so if I look at the, now still at time equals zero, if I look at the entanglement entropy as a function of subsystem size, what I find is for small subsystem, I get this curve, which is just giving me the thermal answer. But then we have a phase transition at some particular subsystem size, where beyond that size, I'm getting an answer that is not thermal anymore. And it tells me about some details of the behind the horizon geometry. In two dimensions, we have this special feature that the entanglement entropy is constant for subsystems that are larger than the transition. And that has to do with the fact that this RT surface is just two disconnected pieces. And larger RT surfaces kind of look the same, except those two pieces are further apart. For higher dimensions, we would have an answer where you still have a sharp phase transition, but you get a curve that now depends on the subsystem size. Okay. So then we could look at, we could ask the same question, but now as a function of time. So instead of computing the RT surface for an interval at time equals zero, we could go to some later time or some earlier time and ask what is the correct HRT surface and deduce the entanglement entropy as a function of time from the full Lorentzian geometry. And so what happens there is that even for these large, so for the small subsystem, the answer is always thermal. But for these larger subsystems where the answer at time equals zero is not thermal, what you find is that you have an increase in the entanglement entropy as a function of time up to the thermal value, and then you have a transition where it's constant after that. So this makes sense because we expect that even if our initial state has some non-thermal characteristics that we can probe by entanglement entropy, at late enough time, so if we wait long enough, then things thermalize further, and then larger and larger subsystems are going to look thermal. So that's all based on this holographic picture, which we are kind of generating using a particular bottom-up prescription for dealing with ADS boundary CFT. It's interesting to ask, well, could we see the same thing directly in CFT? So we, in some sense, we can think of all of these things as a prediction for the behavior of entanglement entropy in these kinds of states of CFTs. And actually, it's possible to understand, at least in the 2D case, it's possible to understand this behavior directly through a CFT calculation. This is something that I've been talking about with David Wakeham here and other people. So this would be using the standard replica trick method for calculating the CFT of an interval in our state. So this would involve calculating the partition function of our boundary CFT on this replica manifold. That reduces to calculating the two-point function of some twist operators. And then it turns out that this transition that we observed on the gravity side, it relates to a transition where, so if you think of this two-point function of twist operators, there's these two different channels we could decompose the two-point function in. And it turns out that for large values of the separation, the answer is dominated by looking at this channel and then just keeping the identity kind of the identity operator on the boundary. For small values of the separation, the answer is dominated by looking at this channel and keeping the identity operator here. Okay. So that's something where we can kind of reproduce that gravity answer directly in the CFT, and that kind of gives us more confidence that the approach that we're using for the holographic theory is giving us the right results. Okay, so in the last few slides here, I want to talk about an interesting possible application of all of this work to cosmology. So far we were just interested in the question of what is the geometry dual to these particular microstates of black holes? We found an interesting answer. It seems that you have some interesting time-dependent physics behind the horizon of the black hole. If we actually look at specifically, well, what is the geometry of this end of the world brain? So we remember that in addition to the dimensions pictured in the Penrose diagram here, then there's some extra spherical directions. Those are the same sphere that the CFT was living on. If we look at then the whole geometry of the end of the world brain as a function of time, well, then that sphere actually starts out at zero size it expands to a maximum size at this time equals zero slice, and then it shrinks again back to zero size when it goes into the singularity. Okay, so the geometry of the end of the world brain looks just like a Big Bang, Big Crunch FRW geometry. Okay, a closed FRW geometry. Okay, so in and of itself, that's not maybe particularly interesting for cosmology, because this isn't really our full space-time, it's just the boundary of our space-time. And so normally, you know, even though that's an FRW geometry, if you were living on that boundary, you would be seeing some higher dimensional gravitational physics. You wouldn't be seeing, if this is like a 4D FRW cosmology, you would locally be seeing 5D gravity. And so it wouldn't be kind of relevant for actual cosmology. Okay. But there's an interesting point, which is that if it's possible to have that brain far enough out in the second asymptotic region, okay, so if it's possible to choose our boundary state so that you have enough space-time behind the horizon, and remember that corresponded to choosing a large enough value of the tension parameter in our models, or from the CFT perspective, that sounds like you need to choose a boundary condition with a lot of degrees of freedom. Okay. So there's an effect which is the localization of gravity on what would be called a Planck brain in an asymptotically ADS spacetime. Okay, so I'll just remind you of that story. So Randall and Sundrum in the late 90s, around the year 2000, pointed out that if you have say just ADS spacetime, and now I cut it off in the UV and place some dynamical brain there, so say at z equals epsilon in some Poincaré coordinates, then it turns out that even though there's kind of an infinite extra dimension extending into the bulk away from that brain, you find that for a range of distance scales, gravity localizes on the brain. Meaning that if you did a gravitational, if you were living on that end of the world brain, or that they call it a Planck brain, if you were living on that end of the world brain, cutting off the UV of an ADS spacetime, and you did a gravity experiment, then maybe at very short distances you would find higher dimensional gravity, but at large enough distance scales you would actually find that gravity looks like the lower dimensional version of gravity. So if your brain is four dimensional, you would actually see four dimensional gravity on sufficiently large distance scales. Okay. So the relevance of that for us is that, you know, we were saying you get this, say we started with a 4D CFT, a CFT defined on a three dimensional sphere, then this end of the world brain geometry would look like a 4D cosmology, but we were saying that, okay, normally we would expect to actually see five-dimensional gravitational physics if we were living there on that end of the world brain. But the gravity localization story, appealing to Randall Sundrum, says that if this brain is far enough out, we would actually see 4D gravity. Okay, so in that case, this thing could be potentially a viable model for some 4D cosmology. Okay, so the punchline of all that then is that we would be using the usual ADS CFT correspondence, okay, which we normally think is not relevant to cosmology because it's describing asymptotically ADS spacetimes. We'd be looking at some very specific pure state of the CFT. That would correspond to some black hole geometry with an end of the world brain behind the horizon, kind of capping off the second asymptotic region. And if we're lucky in some particular case for some particular choice of boundary condition, then the effective description of physics on the end of the world brain would be actually some 4D cosmology. So some 4D Big Bang, Big Crunch cosmology. And so that's exciting because it would then, you know, the exciting thing is that we would have a microscopic description of something like a Randall Sundrum cosmology. So starting with a CFT, in principle, we could ask any questions we want to about that cosmological physics. So for example, in principle, we could try to understand what question in the CFT do we have to ask if we want to know the initial conditions for our fields after the Big Bang at the point when effective field theory takes over and we can just do ordinary semi-classical cosmology. Now, the difficult part of that is that the kinds of questions we would need to ask, so to ask that kind of question, we would need a detailed understanding from the CFT perspective of local physics behind a black hole horizon, and that is one of the most difficult questions for ADS CFT. So that's sort of the direction going forward. We'd like to understand, can we actually make this work? Are there choices of boundary conditions and CFTs to start with, where this gravity localization picture is realized? And then if that's the case, can we understand ADS CFT well enough to ask these questions about local physics behind the horizon that would allow us to decode the detailed cosmological physics? Okay, so that's all I have for today.
Great, are there any questions for Mark? I had a question. It seems like this phase transition with the entanglement wedges that you were showing might not exist if your end of the world brain is too far behind the horizon. So in this,
yes.
Do you have understanding? Is there like a critical point where that happens, and like what the interpretation of that is?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Sorry, I'm just gonna show the picture again. Yeah. So right, what Anthony is saying is that what we need is for this blue surface here to have less area than the other extremal surface, which stays outside the black hole horizon. And we have some detailed analysis in our paper of when that happens. And indeed, what we find is if this end of the world brain is actually too far behind the horizon, then what can happen is that the extremal surface outside the horizon always has less area. So it's kind of interesting for the situation we in to get a viable cosmology. It sounds like probably we wouldn't even be able to use entanglement entropy to diagnose that physics behind the horizon. I don't have a good understanding of why it would be why there's that tension. Sort of interesting that for the thing we really want to do, it seems like we're going to have to answer the really hard questions of kind of understanding something other than entanglement entropy. You know, maybe what are the really complicated operators in the CFT that we have to look at to diagnose local physics.
Okay, any other questions? All right, if not, let's thank Mark again.